Do you know what? Hello, and we've made it to December. It is Phil Kennedy here, my podcast, episode 2. I still can't believe I actually made it to episode 2. Anyway, yes, Phil Kennedy, mildly getting away with it. I think I got away with it on that first episode. And on that subject, can I just say thank you, thank you, and thank you for all of the comments, all the reaction, at Phil Kennedy DJ on Instagram and also on X Twitter. There were lots of lovely comments. And given that today's show, and we are now in December, has a very Christmassy feel, you may notice that the label equally has a Christmassy feel if you catch up with it on the social media front. You can catch up with it on Twitter, on Facebook, I forgot the X bit. Sorry, Elon. Anyway, X Twitter. There is Instagram, there is Facebook, and you can even do it on LinkedIn as well, if you fancy it. I'm getting an email address. But in the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me, pretty straightforward, especially if you fancy having a go at the conundrum. Oh yes, there's Kennedy's Christmas conundrum. All you have to do is get in touch with me via @PhilKennedyDJ on Instagram or X Twitter. That would be lovely. We've got a busy old programme. Episode 2 is jam-packed. We'll be catching up with stand-up author. Boy, he loves a book. He is a bibliomaniac. In fact, that was the name of his last book. He's also a complete science buff, and he's the co-presenter of the BBC's Infinite Monkey Cage with Brian Cox, Professor Brian Cox. We are talking Robin Ince. He will be joining me as he's getting ready for some lessons and carols ahead of Christmas for curious people. Also, Shemla of the Radio Times will be getting us in the mood for Christmas as he talks about that legendary double issue of the Radio Times. And Mark Simpo Simpson will guide us through some Christmas movies and will be asking that age-old question. Die Hard, Bruce Willis, is it a Christmas movie? I'm very much of the opinion it is. Anyway, let's catch up with Robin Ince, my guest. And yes, he is really into science, but he also likes writing. He loves books. He loves going around bookshops, independent bookshops. But of course, as I was saying, he co-presents on the BBC Radio Infinite Monkey Cage with Professor Brian Cox. And another thing that he loves is entertaining. And he's got a tour coming up, a quick Christmas tour. And it's called 9 Lessons and Carols for Curious People. And I caught up with him, given the fact that he loves science and everything that comes with it. Where are we at with science? Especially after Professor Brian Cox is such a TV star these days. Is it all a bit showbiz now?
Well, it's got really showbiz a few years ago, because I was putting on a science event and one of the scientists got in contact because he was worried about where he was going to be billed on the poster. So once you get to that level of egotism from your geneticists, then, you know, we're in showbiz town.
You really are, aren't you?
Yeah, no, I think in the last few years, I mean, having done these, you know, ridiculous arena tours with Brian Cox and stuff like that, and the kind of the level of production values required, what could be more wonderful and show busy than, you know, a night of 1,000 stars, than being, you know, the 3 degrees actually are 1,000 stars and even a couple of black holes thrown in as well.
Where were you at school and science in general? You're always fascinated. I always wanted to know how something worked.
Well, I think there was a thing when I was about 12, 13 years old, science changes. And I think it's a very common story for a lot of people, that you're fascinated by it all. And then suddenly it becomes a set of numbers. And suddenly there's this kind of detachment from the world outside your window into here are a series of numbers and shapes and symbols that will explain the universe. And suddenly the universe seems like a rather abstract thing. And so I think like a lot of people at that period of time, I was like, oh, right, no. I mean, I really wanted to do science. I mean, I'm so old, it was O-levels.
Me too.
And I ended up doing, you know, combined science due to a disaster involving some physics. And I just went off it and I became very much kind of like, you know, down the arts route. But then somewhere in my 20s, I think I was on tour with Dave Gorman and I picked up a book of just kind of different interviews with scientists. And I thought, oh, I want to make some stuff that actually gets people into science again, because I think many of us, after school, that's it. It's over and done with. And we think we can either do science or we can't do science. And really, to be curious and to be fascinated in the world, it doesn't matter whether you understand the equations or not.
Yes, because I think it's the concepts. It's like my youngest daughter, I've got 3 daughters. I was saying that physics is fascinating because, well, biology or chemistry, everything you do, it doesn't matter if it's all the things that you love doing, it wouldn't work unless there was physics, chemistry, biology. And how that works is stunning. You know, nature is amazing. It's had billions of years to work out how to do it. And it now does it beautifully until we decide sometimes to muck it up a bit.
One of the problems, I think, is the curriculum itself, that idea of the fact that every subject becomes separate. So physics is totally separate from history, which is totally separate from English literature, which is totally separate to mathematics. They are a different 30, 40 minutes, hour a day. And the realize that, of course, everything interconnects, as you were just saying, you know, it changes in our understanding of the universe lead to changes in the way literature is written. Sometimes ideas about the universe start with someone writing a novel that asks a question, sometimes in science fiction, sometimes something by George Eliot, whatever it might be. And I think that's one of the things that we really need to fight against, is that kind of idea that there is a strict line which says, and this is physics, and then once you cross that line, it becomes this other subject. And this bit of interconnectivity, I think, is one of the most fascinating things. It's kind of why I put on the shows that I put on with my mate Trent at Christmas time, is because I want people who aren't into science necessarily, but are very curious, to go, oh, wow, this is kind of everywhere.
For example, you mentioned, you know, the writing of a book. That is an idea and that's imagination. But actually, what's fascinating is there's a whole load of chemicals and electrical impulses inside someone's brain that gives you that idea. And understanding that would be quite something. We're still working hard on it at the moment, but isn't that amazing?
Well, those bits, I mean, in terms of understanding things like mental health, from like I've always think that there's a beautiful thing in terms of understanding about anxiety. One of the problems with anxiety is that different parts of the brain have evolved at different points in time. So much of the area of the brain that we might consider to be, and obviously these things are far more blurred than we might imagine. Again, there's no specific lines, really hard lines. But much of where anxiety exists is in a part of the brain that doesn't understand language. So when people get to the point of going, I don't understand why I'm feeling anxious, because I'm actually telling myself, this is ridiculous. But the bit you're talking to of the brain is a bit of the brain that doesn't understand a word you're saying. So again, understanding those kind of levels, which are both, you know, they're psychological, they're biological, and they're incredibly human in what they're dealing with. All of those things, I think, can be helpful.
Do you know what? I know when Nine Lessons and Carol started, it had a different title for a different type of person. But curious, though, I think actually is a really good word, because curiosity, I think, is an underrated skill.
I found it fascinating. When I was touring, I wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Importance of Being Interested. It kind of dealt with lots of scientific ideas, but very much from my level, not from the level of you know, a scientist. And quite often when I was doing events, I'd get asked something that I didn't know the answer to. And I'd say, oh, I don't know, but I can point you to this channel on YouTube, and I can point you to this author and these articles. And every time that I said, I don't know, someone would come up to me afterwards and say, thank you for saying I don't know. We're in a society which it's much better to pretend you know with confidence than to go, oh, I don't know that. But when you say, oh, I don't know that, and why is that doing that? And when you open yourselves up, you then, there's so much more that can flood into you.
That's so true, isn't it? The embarrassment of not knowing. But at the same time, in a strange sort of way, why should we know, especially the way things are, in as much as if I want to know something, what's Robin Ince up to? Well, you just look online and there you are, you know straight away. In some ways, it's not helping. It's making us a bit lazier, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think that's the thing, is that once you say, I don't know, then you go, now I go on a little journey. Now I find out something new. And that's, I mean, that's, again, a lot of the different work that I do is based on the fact that I like, at the end of every week, to see the world slightly differently than I did on Monday, because I found out something different. I found out a new idea, or even, you know, just whether it's a documentary that I've watched, whether it's a conversation that I've had with someone on a train, you go, oh, I'd never thought of it that way. And that's the way, you know, if we can keep changing the way that we think, it's one of the things we've banged on about on the Infinite Monkey Cage so many times, which is, you know, science itself is not about the right answer. It's about the least wrong answer with the information that you have and the technology you have at any one time. So that's why it always keeps moving on, is because it doesn't go, we finished that. It says, oh, we've actually found an answer for that. And out of that answer have grown 273 more questions. And then you'll sometimes get people in the media saying things like, oh, yeah, well, science was wrong about that, as if to then counter that science, you know, we see that in kind of, you know, when people are arguing against the ideas of you know, what's going on with climate change or whatever. And you, whenever they say, yeah, when it turned out scientists were wrong, then when if you ask them, oh, who found out, by the way, that scientists were wrong? And then they begrudgingly have to go, it was scientists. So you go, yes, that's the thing. That things need to keep moving. We should hold on to all of our beliefs with a loose hand, because if, because you never know when a new piece of information comes and you go, wow, that really changes what I thought about the world.
And tell us about how you're changing Christmas with your nine lessons and carols. And as much as it's a beautiful time of the year, Christmas, isn't it? And people do things which perhaps they wouldn't normally do because it's Christmas. What lessons are you trying to bring us? And do you get to sing O Little Town of Bethlehem as well?
Well, we normally have, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 kind of musicians on. You know, we've had wonderful people like David McColman, who's absolutely brilliant, a fantastic singer called Gecko. I think we've got Tanita Tikaram. But we always have a Johnny and the Baptists, who are hilarious and brilliant. But it, the idea is, initially, as you said, it did have another title, which was Nine Lessons and Carols for Godless People. And that was a very specific title because of an argument that I'd had on a TV show with a zealot. And who just kept going, you want to ban Christmas? This was about 20 years ago. And I said, no, I don't. I love Christmas. I don't know what you're talking about. And so because there was so much of this kind of, oh, atheists want to ban, you know, it was absolutely made up. But you get it in America every year. There's a whole story about how they're trying to ban Christmas. So we can never find out actually who they are. So it initially was this reaction to just go, I want to put on a really, really jolly show. So that was at that point rooted to, you can still have a great deal of fun, even if you live in a godless universe. But that was after it got a few years from that event happening, I was like, well, I actually want as many people as possible, because I don't mind what, whether someone believes in a god or gods or no god or whatever it might be. The main thing is the actions that people make and the things that people do. And I know plenty of people who have religious faith and are the loveliest people in the world and are also hugely curious about the nature of the universe. But that's the main thing, is I want people to come out of each show going, wow, I didn't know that. Oh, my goodness, there's so much to take on board there. Oh, and also, I really enjoyed that joke there. And wasn't that poem lovely? That's what I want, is I want people to feel that the world can seem like such a negative place. We've never had such an easy way of feeding into the most negative news. And I want people to kind of, it's like I always talk about Tove Jansson. I want people to walk out of the show as if they've just enjoyed being in the middle of a Moomin's book. Because if you read Tove Jansson, the Moomin's book, there's a wonderful opening to The Exploits of Moomin Papa, where Moomin Papa is sat in his garden at night and he's watching the fireflies embroider their mysterious signs on the velvet dark. So I want those sensations of just like, it's pretty great that we are able to start asking questions about the universe and to create music and to create art, and that we're all together in this.
Shambles. Is that how you feel your life is? Is that how that came about? Or is there reason the shambles, as it were?
I live in a very positive shambles now. I mean, I was, you know, like many people, as Ed Byrne recently said, you know, a comedian finding out they've got ADHD is like being told that they have skin. I've always had a very shambolic approach to loads of different things. That's how I can make a lot, but also why I can sometimes be crazy to work with. So I'm like, we can make that, and then we can do that. And then we're, oh, I need to go and do a show there. And then I've got a podcast later on, then I better finish writing my book. And so it is, it's kind of, I wake up every morning, I work out where I've woken up, and I go, oh yeah, I've just realized last night I was playing in Plymouth. I must be in Plymouth. And then I work towards the next destination. And that's it, really. It's day by day. As long as I wake up in the right city, or I'm on the right train to the next city or town, then everything's fine.
And when it comes to something like, you know, Infinite Monkey Gage and people, you know, your chum, Professor Brian Cox, and he had his own dalliance with the world of entertainment as well. It's funny, isn't it? Most people think scientists and entertainment don't go together. And I think the two of you prove that they do. It works perfectly, because actually, in some ways, I think they are the yin and yang of the world.
Well, also, it's that thing that what we don't see very often in the education system, and the way that, and again, this is not the fault of science teachers, this is very often the curriculums that are thrust upon them, which is, science is so much about play. Science is, whether you're Einstein or Marie Curie or Jocelyn Bell Burnell or whoever it might be, science is about going, why is that doing that? Oh, I was just daydreaming. And while I was daydreaming, I was thinking of falling and falling and falling with nothing to land on. You know, all of those. So it starts off with play. And whenever I always think of when I was doing the Cheltenham Science Festival once, when they, because they do the Cheltenham Science, Jazz and Literary Festival, they're all different ones. And the Science Festival once said to one of the hotels, can we get the same deal we get for the Jazz Festival? And they said, oh, I'm afraid you can't, because one of the reasons we give you a good deal on the Jazz Festival is jazz musicians, you know, they drink a lot. They really love. And then the next year they went, I'm so sorry, we didn't know how much scientists like to have a good time. You can have the same room rate as well. Because, you know, in the bars, I mean, science festivals compared to very often the kind of more highfalutin literary festivals, the green rooms are just filled with people excitedly going, oh, did you see that latest? Oh, my God, that picture of the black hole and what it's telling us there. And, oh, have you heard the latest thing that's going on in CERN? You know, everyone is so excited. And that's what I think gets lost, is the excitement of the new idea. It is not about, the equations are useful. Doesn't matter if you don't understand an idea deeply. Even when you begin to understand just the beginnings of an idea, when you understand why the stars shine because hydrogen becomes helium and that creates photons, and when you look up at the stars still look beautiful, but you also start to think about the reactions that are going on in the stars, and then you think about how you experience beauty. So all of these things are mixed up.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, you know, science, I suppose with something like Einstein, you always think, oh, he's a scientist. He was a scientist, and he only thought in that way. But he was a beautiful wordsmith. Somebody had actually written one of his quotes down on a whiteboard, and I took a photo of it just the other day. And it's, stay away from negative people. They have a problem for every solution. And I thought that was so wonderfully put by Albert.
Yeah, well, that's the, you know, there's one of his quotes on the stairs at Huddersfield Library as well, Sheffield Library, actually, rather. It's, you know, and he was a great political activist, and he was, you know, there were many different sides to him. He wasn't just sat behind a desk, because that's, I think, what people sometimes you envision that what, you know, artists are there going, I'm a crazy artist and I'm just, oh, I'm drinking, you know, absinthe and I'm making these paintings. And scientists are just there going, I better start counting the number of stamen in this garden. And of course, that's, you know, the excitement of creativity is within science and within art.
The last time I spoke to you, you're getting very, very good, you know, big about books, you know, bibliomaniac. That's what you are. You love a book. And what is it about books? I mean, and you love an independent bookshop. Where I live, you visited ours as well. So what is it about books, and where are they? Everybody said, oh, well, you know, they're 19th century technology, but actually they're so much more than that, aren't they?
Some teenagers came up to me after a library talk that I did a couple of weeks ago, and they said, how do you feel about Kindle and things like that? I said, I think any way that people read is great, as long as, you know, if you're reading, if you're listening to books, whatever it is. I said, but I really do like the relationship with a solid book with you. And they went, oh, I'm really glad you said that, because we do too. So here were teenagers who said, well, we love books because you can pass them on to your friends, or you can leave a little note in the book, or you can, you know. And for me, it is, you know, I've just finished the Bibliomaniac tour, went on for about a year and a half, and I finished in Liskeard. And when you're stood in a bookshop in a library and you see all of those minds on a shelf, there is something so beautiful in knowing that we might not live forever, but some of us can be left behind. It's one of the things that I always say when I was doing my show, Weapons of Empathy, which is everyone should write as much as they can. It doesn't matter if you don't want to be a poet or you don't want to be a published author. Write things down. Leave things behind of you. Sometimes write your memories, because, you know, for me, there's been a huge change in, so like when I wrote a book called I'm a Joke and So Are You, and I wrote about a car accident I was in when I was a child and the ramifications of that. Here was something that I had carried with me for 45 years in my head. But by placing it on the page, I could interrogate it in a different way. I could look at it. It led to huge changes for me. And there's that other thing with books is, you know, for a lot of people, sometimes you feel you are alone. And then you pick up a book, you know, when you're growing up and you think you're the only weird kid or whatever it might be, and you pick up a book and you find someone who's a bit like you, and you realize that you're not alone. And I think that's what so much of art is about as well, is you're not alone. There's someone else who thinks like you. I did a show called Reality Tunnel a while ago, And it was on the radio, and I got a letter from a man in his 60s who said, "I've always believed there was something wrong with my brain, the way that it comes up with all these kind of erratic connections and just seems to make noise all the time. And I've kept it all in because I thought I was the only one. But I just listened to your show and I've realized I'm not the only one. There might be loads of us. And if there aren't loads of us, well, there's two of us." And that is a wonderful moment to have.
Yeah.
As a performer, anyone creating things, which is to go, these connections are, you know, anyone who ever says that they're a self-made man is a delusional liar. We are people who are made by so many experiences, by so many interactions, by so many thoughts, by so many parts of our culture. And we should always be questioning why we believe what we believe, why we are as we are, and how we can make the world better for as many people as possible, including ourselves.
Yes, because I suppose you could have that scientific argument about, you know, the association of chance. Is there a science to it or is it just luck? But there's always that phrase, you make your own luck. So there is no science to it. There is no sort of all chance actually has in some way, shape or form been shaped by you.
Well, it's always that, it's that Picasso line, isn't it? Is that he has been suddenly hit by inspiration, but it's always happened while he's been working. And that's the thing is that, you know, there's a friend of mine, Sarah Parkak, who's a wonderful Egyptologist. She's a space archaeologist. Now, there's a good job title.
What a phrase that is.
It's so amazing. You know, they get images that are taken from the ISS and satellites, and then they're able to examine kind of archaeological sites on the Earth in a way that you can't if you were stood right there in that place. And she told me a lovely story about when she was on a dig in Egypt, and she kept having this dream where she was being chased by a mummy, right? And every day in that dream, she would manage to run away and escape from the mummy before she woke up. But finally, one night in her dream, the mummy was faster than it had been before. It grabbed her by the shoulder. She swung round and the mummy just went, "Why have you been running away from me? I've got something to tell you." And what it was she'd been taking in so much information. And the way that the actual idea got delivered to her was in a dream. But that wasn't a dream that came from nowhere. That was a dream that came from pouring in all of those ideas. And then a fictional mummy runs up to her and explains something that helps on the dig the next day. Isn't that wonderful?
That is wonderful. I love the way the brain works as well. That is also truly wonderful and mysterious, but you're working on it. In the meantime, Robin, final question then. What next for you to get away with? Are there any big ambitions? Because you seem to have achieved so much and seem to be achieving so much.
Well, I think I'm very much in a kind of, I would say, a Goldilocks zone, which is once you've got enough money that you're not scared, worried or anxious, you know, which is that you can survive and you know you can pay the next bill. I now very much have a situation of just going, I can do that for free and I can do that for free. And if someone rings up and they've got, yeah, so I try and balance. So it allows me to do an enormous number of different things. And so at the moment, I've just finished doing the Bibliomaniac tour. And then the next thing that I need to do is I'm halfway through writing the next book, which is kind of a book about neurodiversity and a bit of a return to some of the themes that I looked at in I'm a Joke and So Are You. And I'm hugely looking forward to doing that. And then we've got more Monkey Cages as well coming up. So, you know, there's always new Monkey Cages on the horizon. And I think the next one actually is about Egyptian mummies. The next one we're actually going to record. There's a new series out available at the moment. And then we start recording the next series. And that's always an absolute joy because, you know, there was nothing more exciting than finding out that Brian Cox was scared of spiders when we were in Sydney. And our spider expert brought out an orb weaving spider and St. Andrew's Cross spider. And Brian went, "Oh, I thought they were going to be further away." And I was like, "At last, I find his Achilles heel. Wait till I find my funnel web." But you know,
thank you for that intel, by the way. I love that. That's a great piece of information.
Yeah. How can I get rid of Brian Cox? He's drinking too much of my wine. Release the spiders.
Beautifully put. Anyway, Robin, it's been a pleasure. Getting ready for your 9 lessons and carols for curious people, and also getting ready to just take on the world and Monkey Cages. Can I just say, have a very good Christmas and a happy New Year.
You certainly can. And you have a wonderful Christmas. And and I hope that everyone manages, you know, for those out there who might be feeling alone as well, I hope there are people out there who are ready to make those connections for all of those people who are not quite sure what's going on in the world.
Thank you very much indeed. Robin, a real star. You take care now.
Thanks, Phil.
Robin Ince getting ready for Christmas and he has 9 lessons and carols. Good for him, for curious people. And that tour will finish just ahead of Christmas. And of course, next year, 2024, his brand new year includes catching up again with his mucker, Professor Brian Cox, with the Infinite Monkey Cage on BBC Radio. In the meantime, Phil Kennedy here with episode 2 of my podcast. Phil Kennedy, mildly getting away with it. Mildly, I think, is stretching it, to be honest. Last week, I gave you a little Christmas conundrum. And do you know what? It was lovely to hear from you. A lot of you didn't get it right. A lot of you were struggling and going, is that really a well-known Christmas hit? Yes, it is. It's one of those ones you hear all the time. It's very short. It's well and truly under 2 minutes. And it's by a very well-known group. And the question I gave you was, she's candy apple red with a ski for a wheel. And when Santa hits the gas, man, just watch them peel. Mike was the one that got it right. Well done to you, Mike. You got in touch with me at Phil Kennedy DJ. I think it was on Instagram. But you can also do it on X, Twitter, at Phil Kennedy DJ. And the answer was Little St. Nick by the Beach Boys. See? Huge act. Big Christmas song. You're kicking yourself. We've got a brand new Kennedy's Conundrum as well. This one is not to do with Christmas songs. It's one of those ones you might be asked over the Christmas table by, I don't know, a senior member of the family. And here it goes. It's a pretty straightforward Kennedy's Conundrum today. I'm being kind to you, or Christmas is on the way, and it's good to be kind at Christmas. Jimmy's mother had 4 children. She named the first Monday, the second Tuesday, and the third Wednesday. What was the name of the 4th child? There you are. Jimmy's mother had 4 children. She named the first Monday, the second Tuesday, the third Wednesday. What's the name of the 4th child? At Phil Kennedy, DJ. Instagram and X. I'd love to hear from you. We'll recap on that very shortly. In the meantime, though, Shem Law of the Radio Times, his co-editor, he's been a busy boy over the last few months getting ready for that legendary double issue over Christmas and New Year. And I asked him, when is that moment when the double issue became, well, a thing?
It was chicken and egg, really, because if you think back, and you will just about remember it, I'm sure a lot of your listeners will remember it, but Christmas Day was like a kind of supercharged Sunday. I remember as a very small child that people did things on Christmas Day. I mean, there were football matches on. You know, you'd have the lunch and you'd go to the whatever, but and then Boxing Day came. Well, I mean, obviously Boxing Day, I mean, that's a fairly modern thing, but you know, it was a day that you could go and do stuff on Christmas Day and you'd have the next day off. But that was sort of it. It was Christmas Day and Boxing Day and the country didn't stop. Having said that, when the Radio Times and quite a lot of academics have come and posited this theory that in 1969, when the Christmas Radio Times Christmas double issue started, for whatever reason that may be, I wasn't around at the time, but, you know, 2 issues in one, they equate with when Christmas became more of a thing in this country. And now when we have this, I mean, you know, Christmas, it lasts for 10 to 14 days now, doesn't it? Yes. I mean, you know, the country sort of shuts down. You can't get anything done. We had a water leak in our basement. You know, it was a nightmare over Christmas to get that sorted out. But that's how the country now sort of runs. And is it because the Radio Times provided you with blueprint of for 2 weeks television where you were stuck indoors to your family? Or was it something that I think it's probably a bit of both in that respect? And of course, it then became more important because people still buy the Radio Times at Christmas, and maybe not for the rest of the year. And I'm fine with that. It's lovely to have them on board. But, you know, I get the feeling whatever happens in the future, there will always be a printed edition of the Radio Times at Christmas. There may not be for the rest of the year, yes. But, you know, like the box of dates, like the thing, people will want to physically have something that sits on their coffee table that they can refer to, but not because it's easier or but because that's what they've always had and that's the tradition and that's what, you know, they grew up with as children and what they expect, they pass it on. So for me, terrific, that's marvellous. The thing that comes hand in hand with that, of course, is that if you have a very big sale at Christmas, like we do, advertisers then want to be in your magazine. And so the Christmas Radio Times is about a quarter of the money that we make in a year. And that's why you have to get it right. So, like I said, when we're talking about back in the day, it was just another issue. When you look at them, they're not that special. The Christmas Day listings for radio before television came along, and even for television when that came along, they'd make a little bit of an effort, but it wasn't, you know, you could tell it wasn't as big a day as it is now. What I thought was interesting is that from year one, weirdly, the Christmas edition was always printed in colour. none of the other issues were. And so I think they identified the fact that Christmas wasn't as big a deal as perhaps it is now, but it was still a big deal. And so therefore it was worth going to that effort. And they got some terrific people to illustrate some of those. One of whom, E. McKnight Cowfer, he used to do all the sort of tube posters and stuff that you see from the 20s and 30s, was absolutely a genius poster artist, and he did a couple for us, which I am very fond of. But then there's always a danger, because one year they got Paul Nash, who was one of the forefront artists in the sort of British modernist movement and all the rest of it. And he obviously said, I'd love to do your Christmas cover, but I want to research it. So they obviously took it to a transmitter somewhere. Yeah. Because the Christmas cover, obviously, you look at it and you think, why have they put what I can only describe as a kind of oven, or, you know, sort of thing with dials and knobs on it, and it's white, and then there's a kind of some wires coming out. And he obviously got absolutely fascinated by it. But the trouble is, when you've asked somebody who's that kind of big and in the art world to do something, you can't exactly then turn around and go, this isn't very good, because we can't run this. So luckily, once they'd made that mistake, we got many, many more traditional covers.
Shown on the Radio Times, talking about everything that happens when it comes to that legendary Christmas New Year double issue, which will be on coffee tables for a few weeks to come as we go into 2024 via Christmas. And hello, Phil Kennedy, mildly getting away with it. That's the name of my podcast. We're up to episode 2. Yes, we made it to episode 2, and thank you. I must say it again. Thank you for the reaction to the first episode. Just getting in touch. It's amazing how many people, as it were, came out of the woodwork I hadn't heard from for a long time, and it's really, really wonderful to hear from you. We'll be doing this on a regular basis, bit by bit. I will be keeping you in touch with everything via Instagram at Phil Kennedy DJ on Instagram, or you can go via X Twitter. Also, I'm on Facebook, and I'm even on LinkedIn. How very professional of me. Probably the only time I've ever been professional in my life when it comes to doing this. And also looking forward to Christmas, my first ever Christmas with me hosting a podcast. Blimey, who would have thought it? We do have a conundrum, a Kennedy's Christmas conundrum. It's one of those ones that, yes, probably a senior member of the family would throw at you thinking they're trying to catch you out over the Christmas dinner table. And we've got Jimmy's mother had 4 children. She named the first Monday. She named the second Tuesday. And name the third Wednesday. Well, why wouldn't you? What is the name of the fourth child? That is your question. That is your conundrum. And it's there just for you over the festive season, courtesy of moi. Phil Kennedy, mildly getting away with it. Jimmy's mother had 4 children. She named the first Monday, the second Tuesday, and the third Wednesday. What was the name of the fourth child? It's at Phil Kennedy DJ. And you can do that via Insta, Instagram, or via X. /Twitter. Right, time to think about Christmas, and one of those things we all love doing is watching a movie, and especially as we build up to Christmas, we love a good old Christmas classic movie. Someone who loves a movie is Mark Simpo Simpson. Is he a fan of a Christmas movie?
Yeah, I love Christmas movies. I love Christmas songs as well. I've actually got snow falling at this moment. It's more like sleet, but yes. No, I love everything to do with Christmas, and I watch them all year round. We'll talk about this. There are some films which you associate with Christmas purely because they were on the TV at Christmas, like The Great Escape. But also there are films which might be Christmassy because they've got a bit of snow in them, or they take place at Christmas. We'll discuss it. But yeah, I'm sort of prompted to do this because Santa Claus the movie has come out on Blu-ray in 4K. I'd never seen this. And it's from the team behind Superman, the late 70s and 80s version with the great Christopher Reeve. And of course, they had this technology where they could fly things through the air. And so it's all about that, really. And they've got a soundtrack from Henry Mancini and a cast including David Huddleston. Now, you won't know the name, but he was in The Big Lebowski, Capricorn One. He was on the platform in one of my all-time favourite films, Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles, when they offered a laurel and hearty handshake, if you remember that. He was one of those guys. He's brilliant. He's a fantastic comedic actor. Also plays baddies sometimes, but he is perfectly cast. Dudley Moore, he was on a roll. He'd done Arthur, he'd done 10. We all knew him from Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, and a brilliant pianist and organist, actually. He was a scholar in that, but also brilliant comic timing, fantastic personality. And the film really shines, actually, when he's on stage. And John Lithgow, great actor. We know him more recently for things like Third Rock from the Sun and Interstellar. He was in The World According to Garp. This was one of his early roles, playing a baddie. And Burgess Meredith, who I think was the original Penguin in the Batman TV series. He's also in Clash of the Titans. And most famously, he was the coach in Rocky. And what's really interesting about this is you've got lots of BBC sitcom stalwarts in this. It was made on the 007 stage at Pinewood, so I'm guessing they got lots of British actors in. Because you've got Don Estelle. Do you remember him?
Oh,
from
yes.
Whispering Grass. And yeah. Melvin Hayes. It Ain't Half Hot Mum. Melvin Hayes also in the Double Deckers, I think. And lots of, he was in Cliff Richard's Summer Holiday on the bus. Don Estelle, if you watch the deleted scenes that you get with this, has a few lines and he's really good, but they cut them all out. Also, Christopher Ryan from The Young Ones doesn't say a word, but he's very clearly there playing one of the elves. And Judy Cornwell from Keeping Up Appearances. She was Mrs. Santa. And it's a really good story. It starts out with Claus. He's just Claus at this point. He's a woodcutter. And he jumps on his sledge with Mrs. Claus. And they have reindeer, just a couple of them. And they deliver homemade toys to everyone in the village. But they get trapped in a blizzard. And it looks like it's going to be a nasty end. But no, they get rescued by the elves and taken to the North Pole. Taken inside, warmed up. And they show them this operation where the elves make toys for them. And they've got a little bit of magic dust, which means they can deliver them with a couple of extra reindeer in one night. They're not quite sure how they're going to do it, but they do it. So over the centuries, they get these magic powers. They get a new red cloak. They start off with a green one, but they switch it to red. And they're given a new title, Santa, Santa Claus. And they make Christmas that we all know and love. But over the centuries, and there's quite a few of them, Santa decides he needs an assistant. So Dudley Moore, full of ideas to modernize toy manufacture, gets the job. But guess what? When you cut corners, toys fall to bits. So he loses his job and he heads off, looking a bit glum, for New York, where he meets a baddie, John Lithgow. He's a mean toy mogul. And Dudley naively wants to impress Santa by working with John Lithgow to make toys that will be given away free of charge. But of course, not forever. They're going to give them away free at first, and then they're going to charge a fortune for them, because that's what baddies do. And that's all I will say, because lots of things happen, and things may go wrong, and things may go right. But, you know, it's a lot of fun, and it's a big budget and an awful lot of elves before the days of CGI. So that's Santa Claus the movie. And then
a heartwarming movie as well. Whatever happens, every Christmas movie tugs at your heart at some stage, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and this does. It's wonderful. Yeah. And I have to say, this is a film which took a lot of cues from this, a lot of ideas. Will Ferrell, channeling Tom Hanks big in Elf. I hadn't seen this until last Christmas. We went to see the musical and then I watched it as a film. I'd never seen it before and it's terrific. I think Will Ferrell's best role, actually. Another one that we always watch every Christmas, Aardman Animations, Wallace and Gromit creators. Of course it's going to be good. Arthur Christmas, great story, great jokes, great animation. And also, I have to mention Charles Dickens, of course, A Christmas Carol. There was the version with George C. Scott and Frank Finlay. I think all sorts of people have done it. Jim Carrey. For me, the best one is Michael Caine. Never better with the Muppets. A Muppet Christmas Carol. It is fantastic. Really, really good. Yeah,
we saw it last Christmas, actually. We sat through it on Christmas Eve, our whole family, and thoroughly enjoyed it. It's absolutely brilliant.
It's the perfect warm-up. Mm. And then if you're a little bit older and you want to have Christmas seen from a different angle, Bill Murray will put a little love in your heart. That was the brilliant theme song for this from Annie Lennox and Al Green. Scrooged. It's different. It's a bit like Ghostbusters meets Dickens, but it's good. And it tells the same story in a more modern way. I've talked about animation, lots of good animations and lots of films which have sort of cartoon style characteristics in them. They're not always cartoon or wholly cartoon. The Polar Express, this was one of those very early films which I think used stop motion. They filmed actors like Tom Hanks and then created them with computers. And as I remember, the train is brilliant, the animals are pretty good, but the humans are just lacking a bit of reality. Obviously the technology has moved on a lot and it is a great story. Really, really good. These two are slightly scary. My children didn't like these, but now like them now that they're teenagers. Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas and Edward Scissorhands.
You're going to argue that one is Christmas.
This is where I'm going to take us into this category, because, there's a lot of snow in it. I think it takes place at Christmas. It's got a sort of fairy tale element to it. Of course, the ultimate one of these is when Bruce Willis visits Nakatomi Plaza in Los Angeles. They're having a corporate Christmas too. It goes wrong. There are some unwelcome guests. The film is Die Hard. Die Hard 2, I think it was at Christmas, and there was lots of snow in it. I don't know how you feel about this. These are films that you watch at Christmas, but are they Christmas films? I think
Die Hard is. That's got Alan Rickman in it as well. He's always in a Christmas movie, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's in, I suppose, one of the ultimate. I'm sure you'll get round to Love Actually at some stage, but he's in that one as well. So
yes.
He knows a thing or two, so he would have only done it if it's a Christmas movie.
And then, of course, you've got films like Home Alone. Again, not really a Christmas film, but it's set at Christmas. The family go off to celebrate Christmas and leave someone behind. And then, of course, you've mentioned it, Love Actually. I think this is a Christmas film. It involves lots of other elements, but it's one that you watch on telly at Christmas. Like some of these other ones, you can find these on most of our TV channels, either live or on their catch-ups, and lots of streaming services as well. You've got The Perennials, The Snowman by Raymond Briggs, fantastic. The BBC, they always do adaptations of Julia Donaldson and Alex Scherfler's books. This year, it's one that I used to love reading. Tabby McTatt. Do you remember Tabby McTatt?
Yes, yes.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Another Christmas one. This is more for the Americans. This is big in America. Bedford Falls is the setting for It's a Wonderful Life. And another one, which I think I saw on ITV2 just the other night, The Holiday. I think it's a Christmas house swap, isn't it? With Kate Winslet, Cameron Diaz, Jude Law. My children love Nativity. Martin Freeman, Jason Watkins, all the gang. It's just fantastic. It's almost like Carry On Christmas, but a bit more sophisticated. And the final one, which again is a bit more adult, Vince Vaughn. He is Fred Claus, who is the brother of Santa Claus and wants to celebrate in a very different way.
Actually, my brother is called Fred as well. So I'm always happy with a brother called Fred. So it actually really happens. People do have brothers called Fred, even Santa. Mark, you'll have a Christmas movie. I'm sure you're going to see quite a few of them. In the meantime, Mark, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
Mark Sibbo Simpson with Christmas movies and Die Hard. Yes, it is definitely a Christmas movie, but I'm always a sucker for a Christmas movie. And I agree with him about The Muppet Christmas Carol. It really is an absolute cracker. Phil Kennedy, mildly getting away with it. Yes, episode 2 of my podcast almost coming to an end. So actually, looming not that far away is episode 3. I can't believe episode 3 is on the way with some really great stuff. And also we'll get the continuing build-up to Christmas and the new year. Yes, 2024 isn't that far away. It's been one heck of a year, 2023, I can tell you. So that is to come. But in the meantime, I'll just recap on the Kennedy's Conundrum. And, you know, whether you have a go at the conundrum or you just want to get in touch with me, do you know what? It's really lovely to hear from you. At Phil Kennedy DJ via Instagram or via X/Twitter. It would be lovely to hear from you. Get your thoughts. I will just say, if you're sort of catching up late to this, you're late to the party on episode 2, and actually it's really close to Christmas, I'm going to say Merry Christmas now. That's the first time I've said it this year. In the meantime, we have Kennedy's Conundrum, and again, you can get in touch via at Phil Kennedy DJ. Jimmy's mother had 4 children. She named the first Monday, the second Tuesday, and the third Wednesday. So what's the name of the 4th child? That is your question. That is your Christmas conundrum from me, Phil Kennedy. And that's it. This has been Phil Kennedy with episode 2 of my podcast, Mildly Getting Away With It. Good luck with you and mildly getting away with it over the next few days as well as we get closer to Christmas. In the meantime, looking forward to episode 3. Take care of yourself. Thank you.